Today I'm talking to David Batstone. David is Senior Managing Partner at venture capital firm Just Business. He's truly a serial entrepreneur, as you will hear, a private equity investor, but also a professor at the Jesuit University of San Francisco School of Management and an anti-human trafficking activist. You might think that's a curious mix. I thought so too, and so I will be talking with David about his various ventures that include Rebel, a very hip and growing herbal drink, Z Shoes, a line of biodegradable shoes, and last but not least, of course, about the link to his campaign against modern slavery, which he calls Not For Sale. He's also written a book with the same title. David truly works at the intersection between what he calls profits and purpose, or multi-bottom line enterprises. And so the question we tackle here is whether hardcore capitalism can be a good, maybe even a better solution to alleviate inequality and human plight. Listen, look at the links that I provide on the podcast notes, and let us know if you think this is an ingenious, vertically integrated Uber brand conglomerate in the making, or if you categorize this as marketing exploiting people's desire to shop with a conscience. Visit us at uberbrands.com and enjoy.
Please listen carefully.
Well, hello everyone to this new episode of the Uber Brands podcast, the podcast in which we discuss brands that are desired beyond price, performance, or reason. Brands that seduce rather than sell, that add myth to the material and shine from the inside out. We call them Uber Brands, and we, that is your host, JP Kuhwein, and occasional co-host Wolfgang Schaefer. And today, I'm very happy to welcome David Batstone. David is the Senior Managing Partner at Just Business, but he's a lot more than that. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you doing, JP?
Great, thanks for coming, joining us in the show. David is the founder of interesting brands that are called LoveTap, Rebel, and also a campaign against human trafficking called Not For Sale. So here you go for very interesting branding. In other words, he's a serial entrepreneur and a private equity investor, which doesn't seem immediately to jive, David, with things like a campaign against human trafficking, which I found that's the interesting kind of twist in all of that. A private equity person with a soul, that seems rare.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, there's a bit of a narrative behind that. I was a venture capitalist in the technology industry, and I discovered human trafficking in my hometown of San Francisco. And I decided that I would take a year leave of absence from my venture bank and go around the world and understand how it worked. And during that year, it really got into my skin. It was something that I really felt I needed to do something about. And so I took a year leave of absence, came back, wrote a book, but then I started Not For Sale. I wanted to help those who were in most need. Unfortunately, I feel like I opened my heart and shut down my brain, because I had very compassionate, merciful projects that would build villages for kids, shelters for women, all who had been taken advantage of, forced to work, exploited. But I didn't have a very sustainable business model attached to it. I would go and raise charity like most other nonprofits or NGOs. After about 4 years of doing that, it struck me that as a venture capitalist, I had built successful enterprises by bringing together capital, talent, and technology at the best.
How does an investment banker in San Francisco come across modern slavery? How did that happen?
Well, it was in a restaurant I used to frequent quite often. It was an Indian restaurant, and it was one of my favorites. I go there often, but I never had the grid or the screen to see that the kids who were washing dishes or waiting on tables would be anything other than members of the extended family who owned the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So what happened is there was a gas leak in the apartment where the trafficker kept 15 to 20 young girls, and one died and several were critically injured. By the time the police came and said to the girls, "We need to rescue you," and they said, "Well, not from the gas, from him," and they pointed at the trafficker. That whole incident showed up on the front page of my newspaper in San Francisco, The Chronicle, and I read it and I couldn't believe it. I said, "Wow, I've been going there for years. How could I not see that?" You know, JP, I've always been really a curious person. It was like how I needed to understand how trafficking slavery could happen in the 21st century. And I discovered it was quite prolific. And from there, I decided I would investigate more.
And do I remember right, you have a journalistic background?
That's right. I used to write for Wired Magazine, New York Times, Chicago Tribune. So, yeah, I had that background doing investigative journalism. And so it came somewhat quite naturally to me to be able to investigate a problem that maybe others would feel like was too inaccessible.
Right. But then you said, you know, you wanted to go beyond just the typical doing good through a charity, giving money, etc. Because I think you started, if I remember right, a shelter in Thailand, but that wasn't quite satisfying. Tell us about that insight, and then what did you do differently after that?
In Thailand, I had built almost a village, really. It's four different shelters and a clinic and a library and educational facility. And it was great. I mean, it's inspiring. And maybe for some people, that's enough. But I guess I have a very high aspiration. I did the same in Romania. I did the same in Peru. And I tell you, JP, I felt in some ways that I was at the end of a river. And their bodies were, you know, these young kids and women were drowning, and I'm pulling them out. And I felt like I could be doing that for the rest of my life. But I wanted to solve the problem. I just didn't want to, you know, just do something to make me feel good about myself. I wanted to go upstream and find out, you know, how could I solve it at the source? How could I create a solution so that I didn't have to pull bodies out? When I thought about that, I thought, you know, the model I'm doing now is just not going to work. And charity is fantastic for providing immediate assistance, but it's not very good at creating solutions. I thought, well, look, I was a venture capitalist. I know how to invest money. I know how to get the best talent. I know how to bring innovative solutions, technical and otherwise. Why don't I do that in a problem like human trafficking? You know, the same could be said for HIV/AIDS or global warming or extreme poverty. I think we need to come up with new business models. And that's what I did. So I said, okay, talent. I'm going to bring together 50 most influential people I know. And I'll start with Peru, where we had a shelter. Found out that most of the kids were from the Amazonia region. And I asked these folks to help me come up with a solution. You know, there are people like, you know, the founder of Twitter and the owner of apparel companies like Johnny Bravatos and All Saints and American Apparel, baseball players, professional. And I thought, okay, help me figure out a solution. And the good news is they offered me a solution. They said, come up with a beverage that sources ingredients in the Amazon of Peru and other parts of the world where people don't have access to jobs and capital, and then turn it into a beverage and sell it and then bring money back to those communities. Now, it sounded great, you know, in the room. But then when I walked out, I said, wait, on Monday morning, I got to create a beverage company.
Right.
And that's where I said, okay. Now I'm going to put my brain back on. If I was doing this in Silicon Valley, I would go out and find the best entrepreneur who'd done it before. And I found him. His name is Paulo Hawken. He had been very involved in creating the drink Zico that Coca-Cola acquired a couple years ago.
Right.
And so, okay, I got him. So I you know, so that, okay, I found him. I talked to him about it. He loved it. Then the question is, how do I get him to go along with my idea? Well, if I was in Silicon Valley, I would offer him the best salary that would compete with any other company and stock options, ownership in the company. And I did. Okay. Then I thought, okay, wait, now I need investors. You know, I need investors to help me fulfill my promise to this new CEO. And so I went to private equity. Again, I followed the same pathway that you do for building a business. But unfortunately, we typically don't do that when we want to solve the great social problems of the world.
So the outcome is this brand called Rebel.
And fruit, extract, bark, berry, and leaves. Rebel. And it's a great drink. It has a double meaning. One is where we source the ingredients, but the other is around creating a different lifestyle. That be a rebel. Don't drink the same old drink everyone else does. A drink that's great for you. There's no artificial sugars in it. It's a super healthy using what we call adaptogenic herbs. It was higher price than the normal drink that you have. The price point is probably four times what a Coca-Cola is, but people will pay it because they believe in their own wellness, and then they love the fact that they can bring some goodness to the world by buying the drink.
And this is in national distribution in the U.S.?
We're in every state. We're in every region that Whole Foods operates. We're in Sprouts. We're now going into mainstream grocers like Albertsons and Safeway and Kroger. So we're getting quite ubiquitous. We're one of the fastest selling beverages in America. Been very successful over the last 3 years since we launched it.
And what's your way of getting the message out that this is more than just a beverage, is a cause?
It's a great question, and it's probably a counterintuitive strategy. I imagine a lot of your listeners would think that we would try and sell the beverage based on the story that they can help people. There's a couple problems with that. One is that we've associated cause-related products with mediocrity. We ask people to buy it even though it may not be as high a quality as something they normally would buy. And the other is that we can't market a luxury or high-quality product on its own merit and then tell the fans or the customers that, you know what, not only is this the best product you can buy, but it also does great things for the world. And I'm a big believer in that, JP. I think building quality products that people will pay more for is about building the right product, is building the quality product, and then the story is what keeps them there. The story is an important part of brand affinity and brand loyalty. But you don't try to convince them that they should do it even though it goes against their instincts of what it means to buy a product that they're attracted to.
So they'll discover the story once they grab a bottle, possibly already enjoyed it, and then maybe read the back label? Is that
Absolutely.
How it works?
It's exactly how we do it. And it's very, you know, in a modest, it's not, we're not blaring out. It's on the back of the story of Not For Sale. And some people will go to the Rebel website just because they want to find out more about the product, and they'll see the whole background to the story that we started it and that we continue to support Not For Sale. And then the third aspect is that we will then have a separate kind of updates about what Not For Sale is doing around the world related to Rebel, and they can subscribe to that if they want. But again, we keep the marketing and the messaging separate. We talk about how this beverage is an innovation in and of its own right, that we're using herbs that have been used by shamans and by health healers throughout history, and now we're putting it into a beverage. So it's powered by powerful herbs, and we really want the consumer to see, wow, this is the beverage of the 21st century. This is the kind of beverage that I want to drink that makes me feel better, because it's healthier.
I suspect, though, that there are a couple of disciples and missionaries just like yourself talking about these brands. I suppose a lot of the investors in the project also will tend to talk about it. Is that an important constituency that helps you spread the word of mouth?
Absolutely. And so that's the nice double win we have by having such a strong foundation and story. Because there, I would say almost all of the early investors, about 35 of them, were big fans of what Not For Sale was doing around the world and the inventive solution we were bringing to ending the exploitation of native people in the Amazon. So those were the early investors. Those were the early customers. You know, but once we got it into retail, when you're walking through a Whole Foods, it's really the bottle has to sell itself. The product has to sell itself. And so we just want to be really savvy about how we market and where we market.
It sounds great. I guess one question that might come up, how does that not turn into exploitation of the cause? Because I could look at this and say a bunch of U.S. American private investors having this great idea of, you know, fighting modern slavery, but making a ton of money off it and so on and so on. What does it give to back to the people where the original idea came from, if you like, at least the cause that initiated the idea?
Right. It's a really great question. And I love getting that because it really goes to the heart oftentimes of, well, how do we conceive of capitalism and financial markets and doing good? I really want to first ensure that the people who make the product, produce the product, are benefit and are treated with dignity. So we are able to create jobs and economic platforms in areas where they don't exist through the making of the product. I am a little bit suspicious, or at least a little bit reluctant to endorse companies that simply market a cause, but they don't embed the actual benefits to the populations they're serving. So it's almost like we're going to market you, and by the way, we'll give you a little bit of money at the end of if we make some money. I think it's really important to embed the dignity that you want to deliver in the very making of the product. But not only do we create jobs on the front end and how we make the product, but then we take 2.5% of the gross revenue That is not what you net profit, but when you buy a drink, you're giving money directly back to the communities that source it. And so then we invest in the future of those communities through job training and education and better health care, so that they're going to be more able to take care of the jobs and the economic platform we provided on the front end. But to your point, investors are going to make money if it does well. The CEO and the other executive members will make money. I think that's fantastic. I want to create a world where people get rewarded for doing good. Today, we reward people who actually destroy the environment. We reward people who generate sweatshops. Why are they getting rewarded? We should be rewarding people financially and otherwise for investing and working on products that make a better world.
You're not necessarily trying to integrate now indigenous people into this company and ultimately have the vision that they would become CEO.
Maybe that's something that's in the future. Right now, there's not even education. There's not an economic platform for them to build a future. And so we want to start equipping them. It's more than even teaching them how to fish. It's giving them equity and a stake in their future, in the pond. One of the first investments we made in the community based on the Rebel revenue sharing was to invest in a boat. The reason we invested in a boat was a lot of these communities live upstream in tributaries of the Amazon, where they cannot get their products up to a port where we can get access to them. By giving them a boat, they are able then to transport their own goods. Before we arrived, they had to pay a middleman. They had to pay an intermediary who had a boat. And let's say a sack of a particular herb would be $2 for them. If they could only get it up to the port, maybe 10 miles away, they would get $10. So by simply having a boat, by having access to a resource that would enable them to take advantage of supply chain. When we bought that boat and we gave it to the community, I came back about 6 months later to visit the communities, and they picked me up at the port in a different boat. And I said, oh my gosh, what happened to the boat we bought? Did you have a problem? Did it sink? And they said, no, we got so much more gain from our goods that we decided to buy a second boat. So now they have a fleet of boats. And I think that's the kind of future you want, where they're investing in their future, where they see that, you know, we are able to build the kind of economic means that would be a different kind of destiny for us.
Are they also shareholders in your company?
They aren't. I think, you know, that's the future, is to figure out how to create economic models where they become stakeholders, that they become, you know, owners. Right now, there's not an elegant way to do that. You know, none of them have bank accounts. You could possibly do it through an organization that would work with them. And, you know, and I've been involved in community development in underdeveloped nations for most of my life. And I think the problem there is that whoever you give the economic kind of ownership to, you're creating a different class of people. It's very tricky. How do you develop communities where they develop together rather than creating a small middle or upper middle class that is the professional class, whereas most of the indigenous people remain poor? You know, creates a lot of jealousy and enmity, and also is counterproductive. So I really want to search for better structures that allow that to happen, JP. And it's going to take some time and development to get to a point where that makes sense.
Understand. You also were talking about shoes. Is that a related project? Is that with the same people? How does it tie in with the Rebel drink?
It's a different company, and it's really a fascinating story, because I was going back, this was maybe 6 months ago, I wanted to monitor the kind of impact and development that we're having. I think it's really important to keep a very close watch on that you're having a positive impact and that you're seeing a development and growth in a way that's beneficial. And I was going up the river, and I was with my son, Zachary. And Zach and I were visiting a village, and alongside of us was the guy from Not For Sale. He's a Peruvian who'd been working with us in the original villagers where we were working with Rebel. And as we were walking around, our Not For Sale director from Peru pulled out a shoe. And I said, well, that's a really beautiful shoe. Where did you get that? And he said, well, we made it from the materials that you see around you. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, we pointed to a tree. And he said, look up in the tree. See that cotton growing in a tree? Now, first off, I always thought cotton grew off the ground. You know, the white cotton that you see that was more of an industrial cotton. But this is a native cotton that grows in trees, and it grows with colors. And then he pointed to another tree and said, and we got the rubber from this tree. And it's a, you know, a natural rubber tree. And you can see some of the white rubber leaking out of the trunk. And I said, you made this out of a tree right here, these trees? And he said, yeah. So by the time we even got back in the boat, Zachary and I decided that we were going to start a shoe company. And we would, in the same model that we did with Rebel, we would source those ingredients, but we would make a shoe that's 100% natural organic and that would return to the ecosystem in our lifetime. Now, that's really radical and revolutionary for a shoe.
What does that mean, return to the ecosystem? Means once you're done with the shoe, you dig a hole, you throw it in, and it's composting?
Right. It would degrade. It's biodegradable. Now, I'm going to offer a more elegant way of doing that because I have a company that composts and otherwise decomposes organic materials into soil that can be used for farming. It's another company in Just Business Portfolio. But it is indeed possible you put it into the ground and it will decompose. Every other shoe I have in my closet, JP, will be living in a landfill somewhere. It'll be existing in a landfill 3 generations from now. And so all of our shoes really are not for the future of the planet. They are something that are deleterious or destructive of the planet. And I thought, you know, in the 21st century, we can do better than that. We can create a shoe that is a part of our ecosystem that empowers the people where we source the materials and looks super cool. So let's start a company, Z Shoes, and let's sell this. And in a sense, we're going to disrupt the shoe industry.
And it sounds almost like you're becoming a vertically integrated group for good there. So you have the shoe, you have your composting company. Maybe the same farmers also work on different herbs that go into your drinks. Is that the objective?
That is my objective, absolutely. To me, it's a matter of demonstrating that by creating beautiful products and you are able to build on your supply chain, that you can create a world where people feel that they are empowered to buy with their values, that they can buy with their identity. And I think it's really important to millennials. Millennials want to have a greater sense of what they're wearing, where it comes from, and what it means. What they're drinking, that they're not consuming someone's tragedy, but that they're actually building the kind of world that they want to be.
You know, many people are skeptical. You're not the first one to come up with a similar sounding product. You know, there are whatever. Aveda, I think, is collecting babassu nuts in the Amazon. And, you know, Freitag is developing a compostable fabric. Toms and Warby Parker give away shoes and glasses. How are people able to kind of authenticate that this is for real, that you're really helping? Do you have some kind of open door policy? Are there, you know, are you being externally audited? Are you a B corporation? Or how does one show that this is truth?
Yep. For me, it's transparency. It's creating the same kind of quarterly reporting that gives investors confidence because they see a financial return and they can see your P&L. The same kind of transparency needs to happen around your social impact. And so we create certain metrics by which we want to measure how well are we doing in creating a beneficial world. The other part of that is, you know, with Z Shoes, we're going to be inviting our investors and you know, even some of our customers to go with us to the Amazon and see the impact of what we're doing. And that, you know, it becomes a part of a community of trust and who report back what they're saying and what they're experienced because of the fact that we have a different kind of company.
Between all of these companies, I mentioned some of them earlier, do you think there is an opportunity to kind of get together? It seems to me, you know, everyone is doing a little bit in the Amazon and in sustainability, etc. Might there be economies of scale or scope or at least of collaboration to be had?
I really believe that will come. I think it's so early right now, and it's enough for us to build a vertical integration without then trying to also build collaborations with other brands who have, they're moving at an equally fast pace and trying to, you know, focus on the day-to-day bottom line. I think in most industries, when you get to the point, for instance, let's say the role that Intel played in the computer industry. Early on, Apple and its competitors were all using different chips. Intel then started making chips that Apple said, well, we don't need to make chips. We're not a chip maker, right? And I think that will take place. I wish there was a place that gave that justly dealt with indigenous communities in the Amazon, and I could just go to them and say, look, I want to source your cotton, right? We do work, though, with Peruvian suppliers, because it's pretty, it'd be hard for us to go to a group of tribes that live up the Amazon River and say, hey, we want you to be our direct source. There's so much processing that needs to happen that the tribes just don't have those facilities. So we go to local suppliers in Peru and say, look, here's the quid pro quo. We want you to source your cotton from the communities where we operate, but then you provide the kind of technical expertise and the logistics that enable it to get up to California once we've already made the shoe.
I understand. It just seems to me, having talked to Vincent Stanley at Patagonia just the day before yesterday, you know, they're working, for example, very hard on organic cotton, and they try to create this kind of open source where by everyone being able to access it, it creates kind of the quantities that make it affordable and bring prices down. It seems that there might be benefits from opening up things like, you know, materials for shoes that are biodegradable to other people whose brand equities that might fit very much, like a Patagonia, for example.
It's a great idea. As we start getting scale, I'm sure we'll do that, because as Patagonia has discovered, that the more scale that you have in volume, there's real benefits on the whole supply chain. Yeah, and so I think it's really smart. And also, you want to make sure that there's not kind of a chaotic land grab, if you want, but that there's something that's very strategic around the sustainable harvesting of herbs and other materials that come from areas like the Amazon.
What do you do to prevent that this becomes more of a lifestyle fad that might fizzle out in a year or two or three when these shoes are out of fashion or this particular drink is out of fashion? How do you ensure this endures and grows? How do you manage for that?
Well, I think it's very important, not only for ourselves, I would say this for any brands. It's a matter of constantly being inventive and innovative with your product. For instance, Rebel, we started with three beverage products. Then we went from, okay, a kind of a tea-based herbal beverage to let's make it based in coconut milk, more like an elixir and not so much like a tonic. Then we developed that out and became very popular, and that increased our sales by threefold. Now we just came out with a protein, non-dairy protein milk-based drink. Whole Foods just took it nationally. And so I think it's innovation. The same with the shoes. We're already talking about our second design will be taking world-famous artists who will develop a limited edition product with us that maybe only 2,000 pairs of shoes, but it would be, you know, it'd be more expensive than our classic line that we came out with initially. But it would create this sense of ongoing interest in the brand. That probably will go with the materials that we source as well. It's constantly inventing. As soon as you get comfortable and you stop inventing, then your shelf life, just like any other product, your shelf life is on expiration.
What do we have to imagine by now, this Rebel brand, for example, in terms of sales? Like, what position would it have in the beverage market?
You know, it's funny, right now there's two ways of measuring that. One is just pure its sales vis-a-vis, say, other brands. And the other is the velocity, that is how quickly it moves off shelves in the number of shelves. So we're in 5,000 stores now in America, and we're the number one velocity. That is, we move faster than any other brand per shelf, which makes investors pretty excited because they can see us being in 20,000 shelves and then think, wow, what would the potential be of that in terms of revenue? We're the number one functional health beverage in America right now on velocity. In terms of sales, we're like number five on sales for or health drinks, organic health drinks. So, you know, you're talking a pretty good growth. We just closed our Series D funding round. We took in $11 million, and our valuation now is at $32 million. This is only in 3 years. It's a pretty quick growth. Now, you know, the money coming back to not for sale is quite significant. The money that we're delivering and our impact around the world to communities just like the ones that we started sourcing from, it's pretty exciting because that's just one company. When Z Shoes takes off, I'm confident we'll have the same kind of a level of impact. So,
It sounds like you're already trying to prevent the effect that you often get from broadening distribution, which is to have to price down, to have to promote, etc., by creating limited edition, by actually creating higher end products as well.
Let me tell you my strategy, JP, and maybe this is more I shouldn't give away these secrets, but it's great to have common, like-minded people understand. And I'm sure, you know, I think it would be a better world if we got good models that we could copy. So first off is that even in the release of this, I wanted to be very limited, very scarce in terms of being able to get a hold of these shoes. One of the larger retailers in the United States called me and said, look, we heard about your shoes. We love them. We'd like to have them in our stores. That would mean probably, you know, around over 100,000 pairs of shoes. That would be tempting for some people. But for me, that's not the kind of brand I want to build, because then we're talking about volume and low cost in terms of how this would be distributed and how this would be marketed. It's just not the kind of product I want to build. I did this for a specific purpose. It was for benefiting a very targeted group of people, but also for a certain aesthetic, a certain type of product that I would be proud of. Then I had investors call me and they say, how do we invest? And I said, you know, I'm not taking investment right now. We decided to launch this even on Kickstarter. I want the community of people who get involved early to have a sense of ownership. They're the founders with me and my son, Zach. Even the way that we go about it, you create the brand, you create the value, and you create the exclusivity by the way that you build the company.
So interesting balance here between inclusivity, i.e. everyone wants to be part of a good cause, but still also exclusivity, which we find over and over with our Uber brand, this balance between inclusivity and exclusivity. I guess you overcome a certain level of skepticism that's usually there from the more conservative part of the population that might say, oh, this is all this kind of hippie liberal stuff, etc., by really having a very capitalist approach to doing good here. So I guess you unite both ideological factions here. Is that correct?
I either unite them or I polarize them. I mean, there are people in the charity community who are appalled that I'm creating companies that actually are capitalistic bent and are creating goodness. There are people who are pure capitalists who think I'm polluting the business model by trying to bring in benefits for social change and cause. I love the unity of it. You know, one of my best friends in the business community is the CEO of Ben & Jerry's, Jostein Solheim. And he and I have long talks about this. You know, you unite the two and say, this is who we are. This is what we stand by. We're going to create products that reflect our values. And we want to find other people in our tribe who want to buy them. We're unapologetic about it.
Ben & Jerry's, another Uber brand. It's a small world. David, before we let you go, tell us, if people want to find out about your product, what's the best way to dig in, find out, and eventually, if they're convinced, order some of the stuff?
ZShoesOrganic.com. is the website. I think they're going to love the shoes. You're going to fall in love with the shoes before you even know the story. They're very cool shoes. And then if you're interested in Rebel, you can go to just about any store that has a healthy product and find it. But if you want to look at the store, it's www.rebel.co. Not .com, but .co.
And I guess Not For Sale has a website as well?
NotForSaleCampaign.org. And there you can see the kind of on-the-ground, you know, frontline work we're doing in Thailand, Romania, Peru. You know, I wish we had more time. CNN just did a 5-minute piece on our project in the Netherlands, where we built a restaurant, and the chefs and the caterers who work in the restaurant have gone through a culinary school, our students from the Red Light District of Amsterdam.
That sounds fascinating. So definitely recommended reading and maybe watching then if you have videos on there as well. Well, David, thanks again for being on the show. And for everyone who wants to connect with Uber Brands, that's very easy as well. You just write to us at info@uberbrands.com, visit our website, give us your ratings, forward it to your friends. That's what keeps us going. And with that, I hope to hear you again, or you rather hear from me next time. Thanks again, David. Thanks a lot for being on the show.
Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on.